So last week we had started the introduction of this beautiful epic. So as we mentioned last week, Bhagavad Gita deals with dharma. Dharma is not only what is my duty, but dharma is the essential nature which supports or sustains this whole universe. And it talks about that. What is the essence that is holding this universe together and maintaining everything in its place, the laws, the rules. And then also we talked about karma and karma phala. What are the actions and what is the result of action? All that will be covered in the Bhagavad Gita. And then we also discussed pravritti and nivritti. Bhagavad Gita tells what I should do, what I should not do, when I should work, when I should withdraw, what stage of my life I should work, and what stage of my life I should develop renunciation and turn my mind inwards. And a few other subjects we had covered last week. Little bit about the history, as you know, the Pandavas and the Kauravas and all that. So today we will continue the introduction. I hope to finish the introduction today. And then the next few weeks, we'll do the Gita Dhyanam, this invocation to Mother Gita, which actually has a lot of meaning. It's not only invocation to the Mother, but also what this knowledge gives us, and who Krishna is, and who Vedavyas, the author of the Bhagavad Gita, and who Arjuna was. So all that is summarized in 9 verses. So we'll do that over the next few weeks. So to continue the introduction, part 2, so there are 3 important personalities in the composition of the Bhagavad Gita when the Bhagavad Gita was created. One was, of course, Bhagavan, the Lord himself, Lord Krishna, who is the messenger who gives this message to Arjuna. So Arjuna is the student, and it is because of Arjuna that we were able to get this knowledge, because Arjuna asked this question to the Lord, and that's why we got it. And then this whole conversation was recorded and put in text by Ved Vyasji. And Ved Vyasa is also an incarnation of Vishnu, also an incarnation of the Lord, who not only composed the Bhagavad Gita, but all the Vedas were organized by him. The Bhagavat was composed by him. In fact, the entire Mahabharata, which is the largest epic in the world of 100,000 verses, was spoken by him. And as we all know, Ganesh Bhagavan is the one who actually wrote it. But Vyasa, 100,000 verses, he just chanted in perfect rhyme and rhythm. And that's how the whole Mahabharata came to be composed. And there is a very famous verse which says, Vande Krishnam Narayanam Tam Vande Prithasutam Vande Dvaipayanam Krishnam. So Krishna is the incarnation of Narayana, the Supreme Lord, who appeared on this earth with all his glories, all his power as a human being. So we prostrate to Lord Krishna, and of course to Arjuna also we prostrate. We also bow down, because if it was not for Arjuna, we would not have got this message. So we are grateful, ever eternally grateful to him. And Vande Dvaipayanam, Ved Vyasji's another name was Dvaipayanam. He was also an incarnation. So these are the 3 people that we express our gratitude. Now the Bhagavad Gita, these 18 chapters, is not only a discourse, but is a conversation where the Lord speaks, and then Arjuna asks questions if he has any doubts. And that is the uniqueness of this Vedic teaching, where the student had total freedom to ask questions. He had total freedom to disagree with the teacher. And Arjuna at times says that. He says, I don't agree with what you are saying. I don't think. And then Krishna, of course, has to answer the questions. And so that is the beauty of this text, that the student has absolute freedom. Not only this test, but the entire Upanishad literature is full of conversation between the teacher and a student. So it's not somebody giving a discourse. But, and also when we see Arjuna's question, we say, oh, that is my question too. Because Arjuna is a human being like us, who is involved in the world, who is working, and who is at a doubt of what is my duty, and which happens to all of us. So it is a conversation between Nara and Narayana. Nara is the human and Narayana is God. So it is not only a conversation between God and human, but between the higher and the lower. So within me, we also have this lower personality called the perceiver, feeler, thinker, the ego, and the higher personality, the Lord. So it is not only a conversation outside, but it is a conversation within me. So this knowledge has to be internalized. We should not watch it, okay, Krishna is talking to Arjuna and there is a chariot and there is a battle going on and beautiful conversation. We should not just praise it, but we should internalize it. And ultimately, the message of the Bhagavad Gita is the Advaita. That means Dvaya means two, Advaya means not two. So Nara and Narayana are one. God and human being are one. We are not separate. And that is the message of the Bhagavad Gita. Because when God is everything, he is everywhere, then he is in this chair, he is in the picture, he is in the tree, he is also in me as I. So that message, so Advaita. And with that, Advaita comes, if there is oneness between me and God, then also there is oneness with me and everybody, because everybody is God. The tree is God, the rock is God, everybody, even the inanimate objects. So we develop total love for not only humans, but also animals, birds, plants, and even inanimate objects. Talking about love, there was this minister of health, you know, like the health secretary, and he was visiting a mental hospital, a huge one. And so he was taking a tour. And so he stops in one of the rooms, and there is this guy with hair all unkempt, you know, looking really long beard, torn clothes. And he's running around shouting, Sandhya, Sandhya, Sandhya. So he said, what happened to him? So the warden of the hospital, the superintendent, he says, well, you know, this man loved a girl called Sandhya, and he couldn't marry her, and so he got crazy, he got mad, you know. So that's what happened. So we're treating him. He said, okay. He goes to the next room, and there's another man with long hair, a beard, looking horrible, dirty clothes, torn clothes, and going around shouting, Sandhya, Sandhya, Sandhya. So he says, what happened to him? He says, oh, he married Sandhya. Arun, come in the front. Come. Sit down. So the Gita teaches us to love. Yeah? So that is the message. The other message that we get from the Gita is this words called Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. Now, these are the four Purusharthas. Purusha means human being, and Artha means what we need to achieve, what we need to attain. And these are described in our scriptures, that these are the four things that human beings need to attain. So Dharma means righteousness, right action. Artha means wealth. Artha means not only wealth, but all my properties, you know, my house, my business, my, you know, everything that I own, my car and all, that is Artha. Kama is sense pleasures. So not only the sense pleasures, but whatever I eat, drink, whatever I enjoy, travel, all that is kama. And moksha is liberation. So why is dharma kept first? Because our whole life is spent in acquiring artha and kama. Artha means my bank balance, my property, my possessions. And kama is enjoyment, enjoying life. So that is how we spend our life, either in enjoying or in acquiring. But the scriptures say that dharma has to be the main focus. That means even when I'm acquiring property, acquiring wealth, I have to do it with dharma, do the right way. So when I'm earning, when I'm working, my earning should be the right way. And also kama, and when I'm enjoying my sense pleasures, whatever enjoyments I'm doing, whether it's, you know, in my family, in my spouse, or in my food, or whatever, or acquire enjoyments, should also be done with dharma. So my acquiring and my enjoyment should be done under the influence of dharma, doing the right way. That is very important. That's why dharma is given the first. And then the last one is moksha. What is moksha? Moksha is liberation. So the goal of human birth is to liberate myself from this cycle of birth and death, because which we have gone through for, they say, you know, 84 lakh yoni. 88.4 million births we have taken before we get human birth. 8.4 million, starting from plant to amoeba to fish. So it is such a fortune to get human birth. In fact, Shankaracharya ji in the Vivek Chudamani says it very beautifully. He says, three things are very hard to get: manushyatvam, mumukshutvam, Mahapurusha Samshrayaha. So three things are very hard to get. One is human birth. They say, what do you mean hard to get? There are 7 billion humans on this earth. But even though there are 7 billion of us, we only constitute 0.5% of all the beings. That means 99.5% of beings on this earth are non-humans. If you count all the bacteria, count all the plants, the animals, the viruses, the, you know, fish and birds and all that, when you count all of them, so our chance of becoming a human is 0.5%. That means 1 in 200. So we are so fortunate. After 8.4 million births, we have become human. So what they are saying is, do not waste this opportunity. That's what Shankaracharya ji says. It is durlabham. It is very hard to get a human birth. So use this opportunity to evolve. Do not do actions so that you go back to becoming an animal. And which a lot of people do, you know, their actions are so wrong, so bad, that there is no doubt that in their next life they will go backwards. So let us use this opportunity to evolve. So that is first. So we all have that. And then among humans, he says, to have the discriminative intellect to realize that this knowledge is something I need. That also is very rare. There are, you know, 7 billion humans, but how many of them are studying the Bhagavad Gita, are seriously, you know, studying the scriptures, meditating? They may just go to church or temple and ring the bell and come out and they say, okay, I've offered, I lit a candle and I did. But that's not enough to have a discriminative intellect to try and understand and apply the scriptures is even more rare. So human birth with that, and I would assume that we all have it because we are here, you know, discussing the Bhagavad Gita. So the first thing we have, okay, we'll say we have that. Then he says, Mahapurusha Samshraya, Mumukshutvam I'll talk about later. So the contact with Mahapurusha. Mahapurusha means great souls. And in all of you have this commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, so that is written by Puja Gurudev Swami Chinmayananda ji himself. So to some extent we have contact with this great soul, this realized master who appeared on this earth. So we have contact with him through these scriptures. And then also at our mission, every month we have some acharya coming, some great soul. So take advantage of that, because it is very rare. Mostly in the olden days, people had to go to the Himalayas and go sit in the forest at the feet of the teacher and serve the teacher and then spend time. Here the teacher comes to us. He himself comes, or she himself, and they come and sit on the stage and ask for nothing in return. They are here to give us knowledge. So do not waste this opportunity. When you hear about, when you know, we send you emails that these teachers are coming, take advantage. Even out of 5 days, even if you can come one day, listen to them. And if you have an opportunity to serve them lunch or dinner, what we call bhiksha, take advantage of that, because that's when you get to spend time one-on-one with these great teachers. We have Vimalji coming next month, and then Swami Ishwarananda ji in June. So practically every month or every other month. So take advantage of that. So two we have: human beings and Mahapurusha Samshraya. And what I meant was, read this Bhagavad Gita. That way you will come in contact with Swami Chinmayananda and tune your mind to him. In the beginning, it will appear a little difficult because his language is quite advanced. But as you read more and more, and as we listen in these classes, the knowledge will become clearer. So we have two. I have this human birth with the intellect. I have contact with the saint. And the third one that's very important is mumukshutvam. Moksha means freedom, liberation. Mumukshutva means an intense desire for liberation. So I should develop an intense desire that no matter what happens in the, you know, I always joke, we have multiple lives. We don't have multiple lives. This is the life I have. After that, I don't know where I'll be. So let me not waste this beautiful opportunity that God has given me. You know, he has placed me here. He has put this book in my hand. He has given us contact with great saints. Let me use this opportunity to free myself. Even if I don't ultimately reach the ultimate, let me progress as far as I can in this lifetime. Whatever next 10, 20, 30, 40 years I have, let me make this my number one priority. And that we have to develop. There is, as you cannot read this book and then be left with that, oh, it's okay, chalta, it's not. No, it's not. It is not chalta. You have to make it serious. So that, the desire for moksha is very, very important. And we all have to develop that. But that does not come very easily. You have to have the knowledge. You have to have, that's why they have sadhan chatushtaya. Vivek, Vairagya, Shat Sampatti, and Mumukshutvam. So Viveka means right knowledge. Listen to the teacher, we get the right knowledge, develop dispassion, Vairagya, and then develop the good qualities. You know, control of the mind, purity of thoughts. Slowly detach yourself from the world. The world cannot give me that happiness that I am seeking. The happiness that is divine, that is God. And once you develop that, then the desire for liberation becomes strong. So it will happen gradually. It's not going to happen, okay, from today onward. No. But as the more you read, the more you listen, the more you interact with all these great Mahatmas, the souls that come, slowly your desire for liberation will increase. And then you will say, I want to do more. I want to study more. I want to sit in the temple and pray. I want to meditate. So slowly your mumukshutvam will increase. And the more it increases, what will happen is the more you will start enjoying this. Wow, this is wonderful. I didn't know that. That there is such a joy. You know, we always think, this is boring. You know, let's go and have a party. Let's go out and travel. You know, and people who go for these lectures, they say, you know, where are they going for boring places? We have a party here on Friday night and they're listening to lectures. I used to think the same. But as you get involved in this, it holds you. It catches you. And then you say, wow, I didn't know that there was so much joy in that. And then now, you know, our condition is if Friday, if there is no party, it's very good. Nobody invited me. That's good. I can sit and prepare my Bhagavad Gita. I actually feel happy that we don't have anywhere to go. So this comes as you. So that's what they say. The Lord says, you take one step towards me and I take 100 steps towards you. The Lord himself comes and takes us. So that is the beauty of this knowledge. And that's why these are mentioned. These four qualities we should develop. Then the Bhagavad Gita has lot of references to the Upanishads. As one of the verses we chant, Sarvopanishado Gavo Dogta Gopala Nandanaha Partho Vatsa Sudhir Bhokta Dugdham Gita Mritam Mahata. So the Upanishads are the cows, and we'll go, of course, into more detail when we chant this, when we go over this verse. But Krishna was a cowherd. As you know, he was living in with a cowherd family. So they say Krishna is the cowherd who milked the essence of the Upanishads and gave it to us in the Bhagavad Gita. And who is the calf? The calf is Arjuna. Because the cow gives the milk for the calf. She doesn't give it for us. We take the milk. So similarly, Krishna gave this message for Arjuna, but we all benefited from it. So Arjuna is the calf, and this beautiful nectar of this milk of Bhagavad Gita we get because of Arjuna. So the Upanishads are covered in many places, especially the Kathopanishad. Krishna has used several verses from the Upanishads to illustrate certain points. So let us see some of the major points from the Upanishads that we see, we can notice in the Bhagavad Gita. So the Mundak Upanishad, that is the one we are doing on Wednesday night from 8 to 9. If anybody wishes to join, they are most welcome. But each Upanishad is based on a story, on a like a life story. So that's how this Upanishad, somewhere in the Upanishad, the story appears, and then the story illustrates the highest message. So here in the middle of the Mundak Upanishad, there is a beautiful episode, which I'll introduce in Sanskrit and then I'll translate. He says, Dvau Suparna Sayuja Sakhaya Samanam Vrishnam Parishasva Jate. So Dvau Suparna, there are two beautiful birds. Suparna means they have beautiful plumage, colorful, beautiful birds. Sayuja Sakhaya. Sayuja means they are very close friends. Sayuja Sakhaya, very close friends. Samanam Vriksham, on the same tree, Parishasva Jate. They are both perched on the same tree. So there are two beautiful birds, very good friends, both on the same tree. What is the difference between the two birds? So they said, one bird is sitting on the top branch and just watching. He's not doing anything, just watching. Now the second bird is running about from branch to branch, one branch, another branch, another branch. And what does he do? He wants to taste all the fruits. You know, it's a fruit tree. So sometime he gets a sweet fruit. Ah, he's very happy. Wow, 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 very nice fruit. And then he said, let me get now one more fruit, right? One fruit was good. So he jumps for the second fruit, and that fruit is sour. And his mouth is sour. And then he goes for the third fruit. He said, this one will be better. And it turns out to be bitter. So now on the same tree, some fruits are sour, some fruits are bitter, some fruits are sweet. And so this bird runs around, and when he gets a sweet fruit, he's happy. When he gets a sour or bitter fruit, he's unhappy. So he's crying, you know, oh, this fruit is terrible. And then the next one maybe will be better, and next one is worse. And then when he gets tired of all this, he says, why am I doing all this? And he looks up and he sees the other bird sitting happily content and watching. He says, continue, continue. And so he says, how can he be so happy and content? He is not even running around after fruits. And that is our condition too. See, in us, in this human body, there are two birds. One is the ego, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, the individuality, and one is the Lord. Now, the Lord is the higher bird. He just sits and does nothing. He has given us life. He maintains that life. But after that, he says, I am not responsible. You are responsible for your own life. And then what we do, we run around in this world. You know, this thing gives me joy. Oh, it gives me joy. Then I want a second one. And I want a third one. And then I find that sooner or later, something gives me sorrow. You know, that spouse used to give me joy, now gives me sorrow. You know, that job used to give me joy, now gives me sorrow. Or some things give me happiness, and then suddenly a thing comes which makes me very unhappy. And then I start suffering and I cry, oh God, why are you making me suffer? You know, I was looking for happiness. Why am I unhappy? So God says, it's up to you. You know, you come to me and you will get eternal joy, like that bird who says, I'm tired of all these fruits. And once he turns his attention to the higher bird and wants to become like him, all his problems are over. So you and I also have this opportunity in this world. We're not saying that you shouldn't live or you shouldn't enjoy, but do not expect the world to always give you sweet things. It's never going to happen. You know, in the Umrah of Jaan, I have mentioned that before. Kabhi kisi ko mukammal jahan nahi milta. There's such a famous ghazal. He says, nobody's life is perfect. Nobody has perfect life. Everybody has problems. So world will give you problems. There is no doubt the world sooner or later will give everybody sorrow. If nothing else, the body will start giving you sorrow. After a while, we'll get backache and leg ache and knee surgery and you know, high blood pressure and diabetes, and all these problems will come. There is no doubt. Mentally, you know, you're never going to be always happy. Some happiness, some sorrow, some success, some failure. So world is guaranteed to give you sorrow. So do not look for happiness in the world. Think of this world as a place for me to serve and a place for me to evolve. That's the only reason I'm on this world. The world is a bhumi, is a place where I can grow, where I can serve, and where I can evolve spiritually. And while I am here, we're not saying that you should be miserable and roam around like an unhappy soul. Yes, enjoy life, but enjoy like a play. Once you watch the movie, after the movie is over, I'm done. So similarly, I'm here watching the movie of this world. When it's time for me to go, okay, world, bye-bye. Very happily, you should leave. You should not say, oh, why am I dying? My wife, I have to leave. My children, my grandchildren, my house, my property. Nothing is permanent. Just leave it and say, okay, God, I'm ready. When do you want me to come? That's how one should be. Your bag should be packed. Okay, when my call comes, I'm ready to go. That's how one should live in this world, not be just a miserable worm crawling around and begging for happiness from people with a begging bowl. Give me a little smile so I'll be happy. Give me this, give me that. No, I don't need anything from the world. I have God with me, who is the supreme Lord of the whole universe. Why do I need to beg for happiness? So that is the message of this Mundak Upanishad, that turn your mind's attention to the Lord, to the higher bird. That's all you need to do. There is nothing else required. In fact, talking about friends, there is a beautiful episode in the Bhagavad Gita in the 11th chapter. Because as you know, Arjuna and Krishna were very good friends. They were childhood friends. They grew up as friends, and they used to laugh and joke and tease each other and all. They were excellent friends. So in the 11th chapter, you know, those of you who know, the Lord showed him the cosmic form, the Vishwarupa, where he showed that in that form of Lord Krishna, Arjuna saw the entire universe, not only this earth and these planets, but even the heavens, the hells, the demons, the gods, the snakes, even all the lower and higher species, everything he saw. Not only he saw everything, but he saw the past, present, and even the future. What was going to happen at the end of the war? He even saw his own death. He even saw all these Kauravas will be killed and, you know, we will get the kingdom. Everything he saw, and then he was shocked. He said, wow, my friend, he's the Supreme Lord who has appeared on earth. And then he apologizes. He says, oh my God, I am so sorry. So there's a couple of beautiful verses. He says, Saketi matva prasabham yaduktam, he Krishna, he Yadava, he Saketi, ajanata mahimanam tavedam, maya pramadat pranayena vapi, yachava hasartham satkritosi, vihara shaya sanabhojaneshu, ekothva api achut tat samaksham, tat kshamaye tvam aham aprameyam. He says, O Lord, I apologize. I ask for your forgiveness. Aprameyam. Oh, you are the Supreme Lord who cannot even be contemplated. And I thought you were just my friend. You know, Saketi Matva, thinking you to be my friend, I called you, hey Krishna, hey Yadav, hey buddy, come here. You know, all those terms, you know, like we do with our friends. I used all those terms for you. Ajanata. And I did not know your glory, and I am so embarrassed. And not only I called you by such names, but I even teased you. I even joked with you. I even insulted you. You know, with friends, we joke, we tease, call them all names, humiliate them. He says, not only I humiliated you when we were alone, but even in front of others. You know, even when we were with others, I sometimes teased you, make fun of you, even when we were sitting together, when we were traveling, when we were eating. and how could I have done that? You know, he's so apologetic. So the glory of this is that Arjuna himself was such a close friend. And that's why when Krishna spoke to him, it was not he was just talking to a student, but he was talking to his good friend. And Krishna says, that's understandable. That was then. So, and the interesting thing is that Arjuna, after having seen the 11th chapter, he forgets that this is the Lord. And then he, at the end of the battle, he said, I won the war, you know, and that's how he... So the point is, that's how quickly we forget, you know, that is the Lord that is doing everything. But you and I, we start thinking, I am so wonderful. I do so much. I am so great. So that's what this message is, that treat the Lord like a friend, be in love with God, but always remember that the God is the doer. Whatever is happening is his glory. I am just a humble instrument. So, Nimitta Matram Bhava Savya Sachin, Krishna says in the 11th chapter, be my instrument. I am doing everything. You just act as my instrument and you will get the glory. When you do something well and people say, wow, 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 he did such a great job. Yes, thank you, Krishna Arpanamastu. Just dedicate it to the Lord. The moment you get the praise, if you take it to yourself, then immediately the ego rises. So that is the message of Mundak Upanishad about the friendship between Arjuna and Krishna. Then in Kathopanishad, there's another beautiful episode of the chariot. And as you can see, Arjuna was riding the chariot in the battle and he had five horses. And here sometimes they show four, sometimes five, depending on the painter, how much space he has. And then there are reins and the charioteer is Krishna. Krishna is holding the reins and controlling the horses. And Arjuna is sitting on top like the boss, like the Lord. And Krishna is his chauffeur, his driver. The Lord of the universe is a chauffeur, Arjuna. So same way in Kathopanishad, they gave the same example of a chariot. And what they say is that the chariot is this human body. It's this human body. So human body. And Arjuna is the ego, the individuality, the jiva. Arjuna represents us. So I am riding on this chariot of this body. I, this ego, this individuality, whether it's Anil or Satish or Diana, but I am that who is riding on this chariot. Now, what are the five horses? The five horses represent the sense organs, the eyes, ears, skin, nose, and tongue. So with these five sense organs, I see, hear, smell, taste, and touch what? This whole universe. So I see form with my eyes, I hear sounds with my ears, with my nose I smell the, you know, the smells, with the tongue I taste, and with the skin I touch all the objects. So the sense objects are the road, because the horses run on the road, right? So the sense objects are the road on which these horses, which are the sense organs, run, function. So similarly, our sense organs run in this world of objects, which is the road. So the horses run on the road, the sense organs run on the sense objects. Run means run after sense objects. Now who controls that? First of all, the reins. The reins are the mind. You know, the ropes that the charioteer holds. So the ropes are the mind, which means that the sense organs are directed by the mind. That's why my mind says, you know, let's go out and have an ice cream, or let's go out and have some pizza. So the mind is telling me. So the mind is directing, or let me go hear this, or let me get on the internet and surf this. Now, the mind will tell me to get on the internet, but it is the intellect, which is Lord Krishna, who is the purified intellect, the divine intellect, which ideally should control the mind. So the reins should be controlled by the charioteer, by the horseman, by the Lord himself. And in our case, that is the intellect. So the mind will direct the sense organs to function, but the mind should be controlled by the intellect. And as long as the mind is under the control of the purified intellect, the one who has studied the scriptures, the Lord himself, the horses will go in the right direction. My eyes and like I can surf the internet, but what do I surf? Whether I pick up good things or whether I pick up bad things. Same with the people, you know, whether I deal with people well or I deal with them badly, the books I read, the TV shows I watch, the things I do in the world, you know, the good or bad are all directed by the mind, but the mind has to be under the influence of the intellect. Now, suppose Krishna, the charioteer, leaves the reins, then the horses will go wild, right? One will go here, one will go there, and the chariot will never function. So similarly, when our intellect does not control the mind, or the mind does not listen to the intellect, does not listen to my discriminating capacity, then my sense organs go wild, my mind goes anywhere, my actions are all wrong and all misdirected. So that's what they're saying, that always let the Bhagavad Gita, let the Bible, let the scriptures guide your actions. That's what Krishna says. They even say that let the Upanishads, let the scriptures be your guide. Let the scriptures be your guide. Do not, when there is any doubt, when you have any question, think, what would Jesus say? What would Krishna say? What would Swami Chinmayananda say? So he or that Lord or that knowledge or wisdom should be our constant guide. So that is the message of the Upanishads. I'll take a couple of minutes break, maybe get a little sip of water if anybody has any questions, or otherwise we'll continue. Yes.
The Timish mind is governed by pulsion and compulsions, and so do they have a hope of somehow finding the path early?
Whose mind?
A teenage mind.
No, if it's under the influence of compulsions are my vasanas, then it's not. It has to be under the control of the intellect. That's why we tell the teenager, you need to grow up and think. What is your purpose? That's why we guide the teenager. He or she may not know what is good for them. That's why it's up to us to guide them in the right direction. So we represent the intellect until their own intellect gets developed. So we represent the divine wisdom. That's why it's important for parents to take an active role, not to completely control the teenager, but direct them in the right direction, I think. Under their own compulsions, there are very few teenagers who are that mature. Yeah, if a teenager is that mature where she can do what is right, then, you know, let her do it. But most of them are under the influence of hormones.
Mm-hmm. And the colleagues around.
Yes, and the peer pressure, right. Yes.
So if they have a good foundation at home,
right,
and they have good guidance from parents, the peer pressure lessens, right?
Absolutely, right. So peer pressure will be there, but it's up to you how much you let them, yes. And there may be times when they may even deviate, but if you have given them the right foundation, they will come back on their own, or it is your job to guide them, yes. So constant input from the parents is very important. So we need to be close to our children, treat them like friends, not like somebody I have to force or discipline or. Of course, you have to direct them well. You know, friends does not mean then you let them do what they want. So that's why the holding of the reins has to be done by the Lord, by the intellect. So the reins have to be firmly held, not allowed to go wild. Yes.
Sometimes if you tell them what to do, they become more rebellious, some children, right?
Right. I think, yeah, each child has to be handled separately. But I think if you have given them a good foundation of knowledge, and also that's what we try to do in Bal Vihar, also give them a foundation of who Krishna was, who Ram was, all the saints and their lives, and also that knowledge will stand them in good stead. So I think we should make sure that they keep coming all the way till the 12th grade. A lot of times in the senior classes they drop off, oh, I have so much homework, I have so much. And we used to tell our children that you have 60 hours from Friday evening till Monday morning. And just that 1 hour of Bal Vihar, you don't want to go because that's suddenly when you remember your homework. Mm-hmm. That was not negotiable for us. They didn't have a choice. They had to come. And so when they have done all the 12 grades, including in the higher classes with Ravi and Nena, they do a lot of interactive discussion, a lot of high-level thinking. That's actually when they mature more. And so we have to insist and do not give them a choice. We our kids, that was one thing we never, was not negotiable. That was had to be done. Other things, you know, you have to be flexible. You can't be rigid with them. But we said, no, this you have to. And it helped them. They even say that. Our kids tell us that. Those who have gone through Bal Vihar, I'm sure, your children, everybody, whoever has, you will notice that.
What did they say? Like, what do you think, how has it helped your kids?
Actually, Vikas, our middle son, we put him through medical school, taught him all that, So, you know, one time he says, Mom and Dad, the best thing you did for me was take me to Bal Vihar. Mm-hmm. More than give me birth, it took care of me, paid for my medical education, none of that. He says, all of those are not as important. These were his words. I'm not making it up. So because this spiritual knowledge is very important, we must give it to our children. It is our responsibility, our duty. If we don't do it, we are faulting in our duty. And it doesn't necessarily, Bal Vihar is not the only way. I mean, if you can do it at home, but it is difficult. You need a structured environment. So taking them to places where they get this knowledge is very important. And here somebody has already done the work for us. Our teachers who are teaching, all the material comes from Chinmaya Mission Central, and they then add to it and all. So the material is already inbuilt for us. The teachers just have to present it. Same thing, what I am speaking has already been taught by all these great acharyas. All I am doing is combining it and, just becoming a mouthpiece. None of this knowledge is, I would never would be able to get all this knowledge if it wasn't for these saints.
Other students motivate each other.
Yes.
They can teach them at home, but when they come here, they see their friends, their other students.
Absolutely. Right. Motivated. Right. And Ravi, his classes are so much interactive. He hardly talks. He makes the students talk, makes them think. So they're very useful, I think. Yes.
The mind, intellect, and the thinker, they're all related, right?
Yes.
So the mind and the thinker, like, till I think about something, the mind won't work.
Right.
How does the intellect overpower, or should overpower me?
Right. Well, the intellect has its own functions. The intellect is said to be the nishchayatmak buddhi, the deciding factor. And the mind is called the samshayatmak buddhi, the undecided factor, which has doubts. So the mind is by nature is samshayatmak. It is of the nature of doubt. But the intellect is the one, if it has the right knowledge, it is said to be the nishchayatmak buddhi, the one who has the right information. So it is my choice as the ego, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker. I have the choice whether I let the mind dominate or the intellect dominate. If the mind says, I know you're supposed to get up in the morning and meditate, but come on, the bed is so warm and it's okay, tomorrow. If once you give in, then the next day and the third day and the fourth day you will. And the same thing, it can be related to food or to any comforts or pleasures. The mind always wants comfort, but the intellect says, no, that's not right. You need to do the right thing. And it can be anything. It could be a decision at work, whether I should hide my taxes or whether I should pay them, whether I should, cheat the person. If I'm a businessman, whether I should cheat the person or be honest. So there can be big decisions also. The mind might say, it's okay, once in a while to cheat is okay because that's how we'll become rich. All rich people cheat. But the intellect says, no, that's not right. So the intellect, because it has the scriptural knowledge, should be the deciding factor, but it is up to us, up to the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, the ego, whether I listen to my mind or I listen to my intellect. She has one. Let me.
Everybody has a different level of intellect, right?
Yes.
So how come, if somebody's intellect is not developed enough, how can that person's intellect will direct the mind?
You mean somebody who's mentally challenged? Are you talking about? Yeah, well, then that person is excused. You see, when that person...
Or not mentally challenged, but we have like 100 people.
Right.
Everybody's intellect is not same.
Right.
So some people's mind will think, okay, this mm-hmm. is, we can do this.
Right.
So how can you say that like intellect will always direct the mind?
Well, we have to develop the intellect. See, we have to develop our intellect by right knowledge, you know, by listening to, like, first of all, our parents, what they taught us, then what the scriptures teach us, what the guru teaches us, what, you know, so by right knowledge, like when I went to school, I didn't know how much is 2 + 2, right? So the teacher taught me 2 + 2 = 4, and then I went and learned advanced math and calculus and trigonometry and geometry, and then, you know, did master's and PhD in mathematics. So I developed my math skills right away when I was in the kindergarten. My math skills were 0. And so by regular study and by guidance from the teachers, I became a PhD in mathematics, where I could teach other, you know, postgraduate students. So similarly, this knowledge in the beginning seems very foreign because we have never heard of this. The whole Vedanta has its own terminology, has its own style of speaking, of teaching. So we have to develop that. We have to learn it, and then we have to apply that, and then we have to teach others.
So the person whose intellect is not developed enough, and if that person is doing something wrong, is it excusable?
It's not. Actually, the thing is that it's like you're driving 65, right? And the speed limit is 55. And the cop stops you and you say, I didn't know the speed limit was 55. Ignorance. I didn't see the sign. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. If you were speeding, I'll give you a ticket. So when you do a wrong action, the wrong karma definitely will come to you. But if you knowingly do it, like if you knew this limit was 55 and then you were driving 70, then it is worse than if you didn't know. So similarly, having the knowledge, if you do the wrong thing, then it is worse. But even not having the knowledge, if you do a wrong action, the karma will come. But the punishment may be less. So the karmic law will come to everybody. But the idea is that to get this knowledge, that's why, you know, we are all here. That's why we are studying the scriptures. So to get the, develop your intellect through right knowledge, just as you developed your math intellect. So similarly, the spiritual. So there is IQ, intelligence quotient. Then there is EQ, emotional quotient, you know, making myself emotionally strong. And then there is an SQ, spiritual quotient. How much am I evolved spiritually? And doesn't necessarily mean books. Somebody, if we find from childhood, are extremely spiritual, you know, like Ramakrishna Paramahansa, never studied anything in his life. Such a evolved saint. Mirabai never went to school. Such beautiful hymns she composed. So spiritual quotient does not always mean studying. It could be from within also. They might have it. But it is all from previous birth. If somebody is that evolved, Raman Maharishi by age of 6, he was going into deep meditation and samadhi. Shankaracharya by age 5 or 6 was writing commentaries on the scriptures. So that is called a very high SQ. But you can develop that. So in this life, we develop it. And then if we don't finish, we continue in previous life. Yes.
I have a question about discipline. How we are disciplined in certain actions of our life, but then in certain actions like, there's certain things I want to do every morning. How do you gain that discipline? Can you meditate on that to gain discipline on certain things that you want to initiate or you
right.
want to do on your daily lifestyle or your daily routine?
Right.
Sometimes I have a difficult time. Like,
right.
there's certain things. I want to be disciplined on doing yoga every morning, but then I'll skip days here and there, and I don't think that's discipline. Is there any way we can sit and meditate on that to gain that structure that we want to gain, to change, make changes in our lifestyle every day?
Right. So I think, first of all, one has to become aware that this is important for me, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, this is where I'm deficient. So I first have to know my deficiencies. I have to know my strengths, what I am good at. So that's why I should not set myself an unreasonable goal that I have to meditate an hour and a half every day or do yoga for an hour, because I don't have that kind of time. So you start by small steps. Okay, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. So, and secondly, I have to be convinced that it is good for me. If I am convinced it is good for me, then only I will do it. Until I am 100% convinced that this is something that I should do or that is good for me, I won't do it. So first of all, I have to see my strengths, my weaknesses, then decide what is good for me, and I am totally convinced. And then also it is a gradual process. First, I wasn't doing anything. Then I'm at least doing 3-4 days a week. That is good. And then slowly, and then once in a while out of a week, one day or so, if it an emergency came unexpected, I couldn't do it. So I shouldn't beat myself. I should look at how I was last year or a year ago. And as I'm progressing, slowly, slowly it will. Once I'm convinced it is good for me, I'll do it.
Sometimes you're convinced, you're 100% convinced it's good for you. Even your eating habits, you know fruits and vegetables are good for you, sugar is not good for you, but then you end up eating sugar. Or how do you discipline yourself? I struggle with that.
Same thing. I think just strengthening your resolve. And if you're having difficulty, asking the Lord, asking for God's help, asking for the guru's help, you know, the teacher's help. And then within you, invoke the Lord within you that I am a divine creature. I am not a helpless perceiver, feeler, and thinker. I am that Om. I am that consciousness who has taken this particular role, and I have been given this name and this form, but I am not this body. So when you attach to the body, then you sink. But when you attach to the consciousness and watch the body, and then so become like Krishna, control the chariot. Don't let the chariot control you. Don't let the horses go wherever they want. The horses have to be under my control. So the sense organs have to be under my control. Sense organs and organs of action. So what I speak, what I do, what I think, where I go, all that. So with practice. You have a question? Yes.
Is your conscience the same as intellect?
No, conscience is not the intellect. Conscience is that inner voice of God, which tells you what is right, what is wrong. And then the intellect is the one that actually carries out. So the conscience is that inner voice of the divine, which is telling you this is right, this is wrong. And the intellect already knows it, but sometimes needs to be reminded. So it you can say that. You can say it is the purified voice within.
In terms of hierarchy, consciousness, intellect, and mind.
Yes, right. Consciousness, intellect, mind, and then the body.
Yeah.
So is there a subconscious?
Those are all terms. Subconscious, generally, we equate that to vasanas. Vasanas are my tendencies with which I was born with. So to some extent, you can equate that with the vasanas. That these are my tendencies which make me do why I'm doing something. Okay, we have about 10 minutes, so I'll try to finish as much as I can, and maybe we'll continue a third time, and then we'll do the start the Gita Dhyanam. So now Gita is divided into, has actually 18 chapters, as we all know. So they split it into three chapters, 1 to 6, 7 to 12, and 13 to 18. Now the chapters 1 to 6 talk about karma yoga, karma and dhyana yoga, the yoga of meditation. That means what I should do, what I should not do. So that is spoken in the first 6 chapters, karma yoga. 7 to 12 is bhakti yoga, the path of love, love for God. So from 7 to 11, who God is, what is his nature, it's all explained in detail. And then the 12th chapter is the qualities of a devotee. Who is the one that loves God? So that's 7 to 12. And then 13 to 18 are the path of knowledge. Having now seen this body, who I am, seeing who is God, how can I reach him? How can I reach them? So the path of knowledge is in the 13 to 18th chapter. Actually, our Vedas are also divided into 3 sections. The first section is Karma Kanda, just the path of what are the rituals I should do. Then the second section is Upasana Kanda, or worship of this Lord. And then the third section of the Veda is the Upanishads, which is the path of knowledge. So Bhagavad Gita follows the same trend as the Upanishads. Another way of dividing these three, I think Ashok Ji had done it a few weeks back when I was out and he had covered it briefly. How many people remember that Tattvamasi? Okay, so if not, then I think one or two. So maybe I'll just repeat that briefly. So in our Upanishads, in the Chandogya Upanishad, there is a very beautiful statement. The teacher tells the student, Tat Tvam Asi. Tat means that, Tvam, you, Asi means you are. So you are that. Tat, that, Tvam Asi, that. Now when they say that and Tvam, Tvam means me. When the teacher is telling me, you are that. That, now we always think of God as that God, you know, far away somewhere. He's above the clouds, above the heaven, that God. Tvam Asi, you are that. So the student always, how can I be that? So that's how what the message of the scriptures is, that that consciousness, God is not only heaven, but he's in all of us. And we are all actually that Om, that consciousness, that divinity. You are that. So that the teacher tells in Chandogya Upanishad, and then the student understands, I am that, Aham Brahmasmi. So when I say I am that, does not mean I am God. See, people always misunderstand. They say, oh, these Vedantins, they think they are God. We never say I am God. We say God is everything and God is also me. When God is everything, how can I be separate? So Tat Tvam Asi, this statement is also illustrated beautifully in the Bhagavad Gita. Chapters 1 to 6 talk about Tvam, you. That means I, me, that individuality. From chapters 1 to 6 are the path of karma, the path of service, how to work with others together, sinking my individuality. Then in the 5th chapter, karma sannyas, and how to develop renunciation, how to even give up the sense of doership. That is all taught in the 5th chapter. And the 6th chapter is meditation. So first 6 chapters talk about Tvam, you or I. And Tat, that, that Bhagwan, that consciousness, that Lord is talked in 7th to 12th chapters. Who is that God that they are saying is you? So that is explained very beautifully in chapters 7 to 11. And then 12th is how to reach that God. So Tvam and Asi, you are that. That is explained in 13 to 18 chapters. So these chapters are very beautifully divided. And who taught us these? Different acharyas. So we have Shankaracharya, whose commentary, you know, is the basis. Swami Chinmayananda follows Shankaracharya's pattern of teaching. But there were other acharyas like Madhavacharya, Ramanujacharya, who all wrote beautiful commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. Now the word acharya, I would like to explain, because acharya is a word that we misuse and people go around and saying, I am acharya. And they think acharya means teacher. You know, if anybody can talk, he says, I am acharya. And then he calls us acharya this and acharya that and exoart this and, you know, all those terms we use. Now what is acharya is very beautifully explained. I'll say it in Sanskrit. He says, shastra. Shastrartham achinoti acharayati acharati acharayati achinoti acharati acharayati. So first of all, shastrartham achinoti, he should collect the meaning of the scriptures, the correct meaning he knows. And how has he collected? Through his thinking and through his guru. So from his guru he got this knowledge and he collected the true meaning of the scriptures. Then after having got the meaning, he just not satisfied. Acharati. Then he lives that knowledge. He becomes the visible image of Gita. When you saw Swami Chinmayananda, you could see Gita walking. When you saw Mahatma Gandhi, you saw Bhagavad Gita in practice. When you see all these great teachers, they not only, they say, no, not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. So they also did what the script, what they taught others. They practiced it and they applied that. So first they studied, then acharati, then they lived it, and then acharayati. And then they teach others how to live that. So that is only one who can call himself acharya or herself. One who has studied the scriptures, knows the meaning, lives that life, and then teaches others how to live that life. So if you do all three things, then please go around and call yourself Acharya. Otherwise, please don't do that. So that is... Yeah, they call themselves Acharya. Well, if they, do they do all those three? You tell them. You, they cannot call themselves Acharya. They, or even they call themselves Swami and all. You know, that's up to them. I'm not nobody to judge. But I would definitely not call myself Acharya. Because unless you can do those three things, unless you know the scriptures, unless you live it, and unless you teach others how to live it and encourage them, you cannot call yourself Acharya.
I think it's not that Acharya is telling that I am Acharya, but other people look at him as Acharya.
Yes, yes.
It's not, he doesn't announce that I am Acharya.
No, some people do.
Some people do.
But some people
are not really Acharya.
Right.
Those who announce, I don't believe they're Acharya.
Right,
they,
I agree.
They put it in their way as Acharya.
Yeah, they put Acharya, 108 and all. Yeah, they do that. But and others others also should be very careful. If you call somebody Acharya, does he fulfill these three criteria? Unless he doesn't, he doesn't deserve to be called Acharya. You may call anybody Acharya, but it's like you may call anybody, you know, PhD, but he's not, you may call him doctor, but he, unless he has done the PhD, he doesn't qualify. All right. So now, just quickly, we have about 4 more minutes. So when does God appear? You know, Krishna says in the 18th chapter, whenever dharma goes down, also in the 4th chapter, he says, whenever dharma goes down and adharma increases, when bad things increase and good things get less, then I appear. So, what do they mean by dharma and adharma? So, we had talked about pravritti and nivritti, what I should do and what I should not do. So, when in the world... pravritti, the wrong kind of activities increase. That's why, you know, when Kamsa, the demon king, was so powerful, Krishna appeared. When Ravana was so powerful, Ram appeared. Not only wrong things, but wrong knowledge, like wrong ideas. Like when, you know, wrong ideas were there, great masters appeared like Buddha and Jesus and Shankaracharya to reestablish the right knowledge. So when the wrong things are increasing and nivritti and people are becoming very lazy, becoming very tamasic. So when rajas increases, wrong activities, and tamas also increases. Tamas means don't care, you know, let whatever happen. So when people become careless, when people become lazy and allow wrong things to happen, then God has to appear. So that's what they say in the world, you know, like... Shankaracharya ji, when did he come? When nivritti was there, when people had who had studied Buddhism but did not study the true principles of Buddha, wrongly applied that, and everybody started becoming monk, becoming Buddhist monk and traveling and not working, and the Indian society was going down. Shankaracharya ji came and said, I need to remove this. And he did. He removed the wrong ideas of Buddhism totally out of India and reestablished the Advaita philosophy. So that's what they say. God appears in different forms. He appeared as, you know, Shankaracharya ji. And then we believe that Shankaracharya ji appeared as Gurudev. So the point is that whenever the wrong ideas are there, the right teacher appears to establish dharma. And where does that God appear? In the pure heart. As we know, Krishna was born to Devaki and Vasudevan, who were very pure individuals and had done a lot of tapas, lot of austerity. So if we want God to appear in our heart, God is in all our hearts, but if we want him to manifest, we have to do purity of heart and austerity. When we do those two things, then God will appear. And that's what they say, that the study of the Bhagavad Gita will only bear fruit if you have done those two things. Tapas, do some austerity, live a life of self-control, and live a life of purity. Love, compassion, kindness, sharing, you know, unselfishness. So that is the message of this Bhagavad Gita, that God appears in our heart when we have that. Last point, then we'll end, and the rest I'll do next week, is who is the student? Now in the Upanishads, we know Upanishads are the basis of the Bhagavad Gita. The Upanishads, the student was a very evolved student who had already seen the world and realize the world is not going to give me joy. And so he leaves everything, goes and approaches to a teacher in the Himalayas or in the forest and says, I'm here to surrender to you. I'm here to serve you and I'm here to learn because I know the world is not going to give me happiness. And he has already studied some of the scriptures. That's why they say Pariksha Lokan, Karma Chitan Brahmana. He has seen this world and said, it's not going to give me joy. But in the Bhagavad Gita, the student Arjuna is not that evolved. He has not seen the world. He has not developed detachment. In fact, he wants to get involved in the world. He wants to fight the battle because he realizes that these people have been very unjust. They have been very wicked. They have been very cruel and I need to remove them. But at the last minute, he has a doubt just as a student. Having studied all the year round, suddenly on the day of the exam, he says, Dad, I don't think I can study. I don't think I can pass. I don't think I can. You know, people get cold feet. And the dad says, don't worry, son. You will be fine. I'll drive you to the exam and I'll stay there and I'll make sure you do well. I'll be with you. Don't feel you are alone. So same way Krishna says, Arjuna, don't worry. I am with you. I'll drive your chariot and I'll take you. So that is the essence of this Gita, that Arjuna is like you and me. He's not like the Upanishad students who have already studied and very evolved and they just want the final knowledge. But they are. That's why Gita is very applicable because Arjuna, we can see ourselves in Arjuna. So that's why there's a difference between the student of the Upanishads and student of the Gita. So we'll end with the closing prayer. And then next week, I'll just very briefly finish the introduction and then we'll start the Gita Dhyanam. We'll finish, learn the chanting over the next 2-3 weeks. And then every week, we'll chant the entire Gita Dhyanam before we do the Gita, until the Gita Dhyanam is finished. So that's why I, just to save a little time, we didn't do the meditation today. We'll end with the closing prayer. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Makaschid Dukha Bhagbhave. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Guru Hari Om.